The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. On this week's program, parents in the West Bank send their children to work so the family can eat.
I worry all the time about the traffic, the cars, the sun, the bad people. All these things worry me. I'm never at peace when the boys are out.
Plus, boxing your way out of poverty in Nigeria. And in Pakistan, an encounter with some expert mechanics.
We limped into a service bay and were greeted by five or six small children wearing grease-stained aprons and carrying toolboxes. When we told them what was wrong, one boy opened the hood while the others sprang on the car like monkeys, looking for stuff to fix.
First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. One of the major challenges for people living in the West Bank is the hundreds of checkpoints in the area. They're scattered throughout the territory and they run along the border with Israel. Controls at the checkpoints have become much stricter in recent years. Because of security issues, thousands of West Bank adults who used to make a living in Israel can no longer cross the border to get to work. In some families now, it's up to the children to help make money. Megan Williams reports.
It's a windy weekday morning near an Israeli checkpoint by the West Bank town of Ramallah. Yellow minivans pull up and unload the small groups of passengers that are crossing over into Israel. That's when the boys who make a living around these checkpoints spring into action. Some push carts of luggage or bags for the passengers. Others hawk peanuts or plastic holders for the identity cards Palestinians need to get into Israel. 11-year-old Ehab stands counting out the packs of gum he sells from a shoebox. His dark brown eyes cast a world-weary gaze. I get up early in the morning, at 6 or sometimes 7, Ehab says. I wash, I get dressed, and I go to work. I sell things all day, and then I go home at the end of the day, at 6 or so. Ehab admits, even on school days, he sometimes comes here to make some money. Today, it's not yet noon, and normally he'd have about 6 more hours of work ahead of him, with a quick pita sandwich break for lunch. Instead, after we stand talking for a while, he invites me to his home to meet his family. We're off in one of the minivans, heading toward El Ajouri, a hillside neighborhood about a 15-minute ride from Ramallah. Music blares as we roll away from town. Ehab's mother, Ratiba, and his father's other wife, Samia, are surprised to see him back so early and with a visitor. But they welcome me into a large room lined with cushions and brass teapots. It's a clean, comfortable space that doubles as the bedroom for their 7 children. Samiha makes tea while Ratiba invites me to sit. The women tell me that Ehab and his 2 younger brothers have been supporting the family for the past year or so, bringing in about $12 a day by selling gum in downtown Ramallah and at the nearby checkpoint. Ehab's father used to earn twice that amount selling shoes. But in the past few years, in an effort to prevent terrorist attacks, Israel has drastically cut the number of work permits it grants Palestinians. Thousands who used to cross over to make a living are now stuck unemployed in the West Bank, like Ehab's father. And now, Ratiba tells me, he's too sick with heart problems to work even in nearby Ramallah. She hates it, she says, but she has to send her boys out to work.
I worry all the time about the traffic, the cars, the sun, the bad people. All these things worry me. I'm never at peace when the boys are out.
Sometimes, she says, Ehab and his brothers will come up with an excuse to come home and play. But unless there's violence on the street, she sends them back, even if they're tired. This is especially tough on Ehab, who has a club foot. It hurts him to stand all those hours, but there's just not the money to buy the corrective shoes he needs.
Of course, I want them to live a normal childhood. I always feel guilty when I see other children playing, enjoying their childhood, and knowing my kids don't have time to play, that they must work to help us survive.
Ihab, who looks so tough on the street, playfully careens around the living room on a tricycle with his little brother. I ask Ratiba if she worries about her sons being recruited into a terrorist group while they're out on the street. Yes, she says. But her biggest fear is something else, a fear many parents share no matter where they live. She looks nervously at Ihab, who stopped playing. He stands stiffly beside her, listening. Last year, she begins, while Ihab was working in Ramallah, a man tried to molest him.
The boy was shocked. He didn't know what was happening to him. The man exposed himself, tried to take off his pants. And when my son came home, he didn't know how to explain it to us. It wasn't until my husband calmed him down that slowly we understood.
Ihab fidgets, his eyes darting nervously around the room. With Ratiba looking on gloomily, he moves away from her toward the door. He wants to get back to work, he explains, and make extra money today so he can replenish his stock tomorrow. We get up and say our goodbyes and get back on another minivan. In downtown Ramallah, we get off. Ihab's keen to get on his way. His goal is to sell 50 packs of gum today, and he's only halfway there. If he has any fears about going back on the street, he's not letting on. I ask him if he feels more like a boy or a man. A man, Ihab answers, chuckling a bit at the question. Then he slips away by himself, disappearing down the busy street. For the World Vision Report, I'm Megan Williams in Ramallah, the West Bank.
The economic downturn in this country has had a ripple effect in emerging markets like Mexico. But that's nothing new for many Mexicans who were already living on the edge. Conrad Fox reports from Oaxaca City, Mexico.
It's mid-morning at the Oaxaca City dump. Pedro Garcia and several other men and women stand knee-deep in trash, sifting through it for plastic bottles, cardboard, metal, or anything else they can sell. Garcia rips open a plastic bag. Rotting vegetables and old diapers flop out. He reaches into the bag and pulls out a plastic Coke bottle. The pickers here can resell the bottles to a recycling company for about 9 cents a pound. It's a good thing for Garcia and his fellow garbage pickers that city folk don't put their plastic bottles in recycling bins.
It's better for us that it makes it to the dump like this. If the garbage was separated, then plastic like this wouldn't even make it to us. The garbage collectors in the city would have already grabbed it for themselves. All mixed up like this, they don't want to touch it.
36 families make a living from this garbage dump. They work nimbly around the dump truck and the bulldozer that plows the garbage flat. There are men and women of all ages, even some children. There's a heavy stench in the air, and it's dangerous too. I almost step on some hospital needles, but Garcia warns me off. Despite it all, spirits are high. The garbage pickers joke among themselves. Garcia has been working here for 3 years. He used to sell plastic dishware door to door, but says his business failed. He admits he didn't like working here at first.
It's really gross. Sometimes you find dead dogs and stuff. I used to vomit when I first started. Man, my head would hurt. Sometimes I couldn't eat. I wanted to quit, but I've got kids to support.
Three of his children sit on the ground playing. They're surrounded by car parts, rusted metal, tin cans. They amuse themselves with an electronic game their father found on the dump. 12-year-old Jorge, the oldest, says the dump smells bad. Although, he sometimes does help out his dad.
Sometimes, I look for aluminum, plastic. Sometimes, we get perfume. There's a woman who comes on Mondays to buy perfume.
By perfume, he means empty brand-name perfume bottles. Buyers fill them with cheap imitations and sell them as originals on the black market. The extra income from the bottles is a godsend, says Garcia. That's because there's not much here that's valuable.
These days, you hardly ever see high-priced recyclables like copper, bronze, and iron. The municipal garbage collectors take it all, or almost all.
In the afternoon, several garbage pickers place old computer monitors in the path of the bulldozer. After they're smashed, the pickers race to pull out the copper wires from the crushed plastic. In all, they collect $5 worth of copper, but none of it is for Garcia today. The garbage pickers here have an understanding among themselves. Everyone gets a different day to pick over special loads like this one. It's not Garcia's turn today. But there are enough plastic bottles to go around. By 6 p.m., Garcia has already collected over 100 pounds of plastic bottles. He loads them, and the other items he's rescued from the dump, onto the back of his rattling old truck. Then he drives the few hundred yards to a lot, where he'll store it all. Next week, he'll sell everything to a local recycling company. This work earns him just enough to feed his family. But he prefers it to migrating to the U.S.
Sure, you make more there, but it's dangerous crossing the border. I don't want to take the risk. Something could happen to me and my kids would be alone. Even though I don't have money and a nice house, at least I'm here with my kids.
Garcia often works every day of the week, but he won't be back tomorrow. He's got a parent-teacher meeting for his son, Jorge. Garcia hopes his son does well in school, so he won't have to work as a garbage picker. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Oaxaca City's municipal dump.
And if the Garcia family turns on the radio when they get home, this is what they might hear.
Paso el tiempo en mi habitación. Paso el tiempo ya sin ti. En mis fotografías.
That's Paso el Tiempo, and it's sung by Bella Nova, a Latin Grammy Award-winning band from Mexico. Coming up, more music, this time from world music star Angelique Kidjo. That's a little later in the show. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. There hasn't been a stable government in Somalia since 1991, when the central government collapsed. That's when Somaliland broke away from Somalia and declared independence. But not a single country has recognized Somaliland as a bona fide nation. That means it's not eligible for international aid or loans. It's a struggle to make the economy work. And unemployment is high. Some say 90% of men in the capital are without jobs. But that doesn't mean the women aren't hard at work. Richard Locke reports from the capital, Hargeisa, in part two of our series on Somaliland.
The market in Hargeisa is cramped with women vendors. There's a young lady hidden behind a full hijab who's selling cell phone accessories. Next door to her, an elderly woman slumps into a plastic chair behind a full array of kitchen utensils. And nearby, Safia Hassan takes the plastic wrapper of an embroidered headscarf as she tries to make a sale. The 32-year-old stands beneath a makeshift roof made of tarpaulin sheets. Set out on shelves are her wares, anything and everything, from Chinese-made sneakers to polyester shirts.
We women are doing all the business. We start off with little, but we are patient, and now our businesses are growing, and so are our incomes. The breadwinners in Somaliland now are the women.
Most women traders here have stories of hardship, and Hassan, a mother of five, is no exception.
My husband hasn't worked for years, so it was left to me to support the family. I had to sell the little gold I had to raise the capital to start this business. I brought a few clothes from other ladies and built up my business to what it is today.
In fact, Hassan's husband hasn't ever held a steady job. As she rearranges a row of cheap Chinese shirts, she tries to justify her husband's idleness.
My husband wants to have a good office job with a good monthly salary, but these jobs simply aren't available. One day perhaps our country will be recognized and then our husbands will have work.
Somalilanders, especially the men, argue that international recognition of their country would bring more trade, a better economy, and more jobs. And there is some truth to that. Somaliland's women will tell you that there's work to be had, but the men here are too proud to run market stalls. Just outside the marketplace, in the Dubai beauty salon, Amal Abdi ties blonde extensions into the hair of two giddy 20-somethings.
Every woman wants to look like a princess for her wedding. I have to make that dream come true for as cheap a price as possible.
Abdi launched her business a year and a half ago when it became painfully apparent her husband would never work. The decision forced her to go against her beliefs.
My religion doesn't allow women to work. But the problem is that the men aren't working. They just sit around and then return home for dinner in the evening.
The conservative brand of Islam practiced here dictates that a wife runs the household while the husband earns the crust. Sheikh Ismail Hure is one of Somaliland's most prominent imams.
The main work of the women in Islam society or in Muslim society is to care of the house. That is the important. She is the interior minister in the family. And the father, maybe we can say he is the external minister or foreign affairs. He must go to earn for the home.
But that isn't happening here. And Hure, one of the more moderate thinkers among his colleagues, points to one reason why. He admits the scarcity of working men has less to do with a bad economy than with the practice of chewing cat, a plant whose leaves produce a natural high.
I think chewing cat is one of our social problems. The man, he sits 8 hours chewing. He's not working. He's talking only. So cat is a waste of time.
In this situation, says Hure, Islam should be flexible.
The woman, she was compelled to come out of the house and earn for herself, to support her family.
Of course, not all men here are cat-chewing idlers.
I know some say tailoring is the work of a woman. These days, women are in offices performing men's jobs, so we are all on the same level.
At the back of his stall in the Hargeisa market, 26-year-old Khada Muhammad stitches together a kufia cap worn by Somali men. Muhammad's friends routinely tease him for his work and suggest he spend his days like a true man here, chewing cat. But the newlywed isn't interested.
If I chew, who is going to earn money for me? I am proud of doing this work. This is all I have, but I am proud that I earn an income.
There are, however, few men like Muhammad. Just a few feet away from Muhammad's stall, Safia Hassan's 12-hour workday is drawing to a close. Business in the market has been slow, and now she has to slave over dinner for her husband. On days like this, Hassan confesses, she often feels like packing it all in.
Sometimes I think I should leave this business, sell up, take the money and run to another country.
But she won't. Hassan's too determined to succeed where her husband is failing. And above all, she knows she can't let her children down. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Hargeisa, Somaliland.
A bit later in the show, we'll hear about something unusual for sale on the streets of Hargeisa. Stay with us as we continue our look at the little-known region on the Horn of Africa. The International Labor Organization estimates that nearly a quarter of a billion children work full-time. That can mean anything from the kid working in a sweatshop to the one working on your car. Will Everett sent us this reporter's notebook from Pakistan.
It was nearly evening when the engine of the old rattletrap taxi began acting up. My driver said we'd need to find a mechanic, and fast. We were driving through the tribal area of western Pakistan, not the sort of place you'd want to find yourself stranded in after dark. Like a mirage in the desert, a cluster of machine shops sprang into view just off the highway. We limped into a service bay and were greeted by five or six small children wearing grease-stained aprons and carrying toolboxes. When we told them what was wrong, one boy opened the hood while the others sprang on the car like monkeys, looking for stuff to fix. Shabir, the boy working under the hood, was only 8 years old. He inspected the distributor cap, removed the spark plug cables, and began taking out the plugs for inspection. As he did so, he listed off all the things he knew how to do under the hood. Turns out he could do just about anything, from changing out a radiator to tearing down a carburetor. He'd only been doing this for a year or so, and had decided that being a mechanic was his life's vocation. He'd never been to school, but his boss, a gray-bearded man in his 60s, said he was getting all the schooling he needed right here. He said, this kid is a fast learner. He's going to go far in this field. So why does he need to know about world history or geometry? While the taxi was being repaired, I took a walk around. I saw that the boys all slept together in a dirty concrete shed with a greasy piece of burlap for a door. A few wooden clubs leaned against the wall, since at night the kids were in charge of guarding against thieves. Naturally, I was curious to know if Shabir made good money at this.
Yeah, he makes good money, 20 rupees a day.
A day?
Yeah.
When I did the math, I couldn't believe it. He worked from 8 in the morning till 8 at night for slightly more than 25 cents. Even by Pakistani standards, it was ridiculous. And yet, he said he was happy here. He thought the pay was just fine, and his boss saw to it that he got 2 meals a day. When he had finished installing a new set of spark plugs, he nodded for our driver to start the engine. It sounded great, but I realized it was customers like us who made this sort of exploitation possible. Shabir would work a 12-hour day for the price of a single soft drink. The cost of replacing the spark plugs would come out to around $5, most of which would go into the pocket of the man with the gray beard. I thought of all the child vendors from whom I'd bought something on this trip, from the little girl selling coconut slices on the bus, to the boy who'd fixed a hole in my boots. What's a responsible traveler supposed to do? Further their servitude or deprive them of an income? I wasn't paying for the repair, but should I have told the taxi driver to find another mechanic? I thought that in this case I'd soothe my conscience by giving Shabir a dollar tip, 4 days' wages. But as we drove off, I saw him dutifully hand the money over to his boss. We got to our destination safely, thanks to Shabir and his young helpers. Once we arrived, we stopped at a restaurant for dinner. Sure enough, our waiter was 11 years old.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. There are pictures of the little mechanics on our website, worldvisionreport.org. That's the voice of Miriam Makeba. The superstar from Africa died over a year ago. But you can still hear her influence in the music of the many African musicians she inspired. Angelique Kidjo is one of them. Our guide to global music, Ish Mafundukwa, is here again to talk about her. Hi, Ish. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Peggy.
Let's talk a little about Angelique. How did she first start her singing career?
Angelique started off very early in life. She was only 6 when she started singing and dancing with the country's theater group, of which her mother was the director. And then at 10, she heard Miriam Makeba. And she said it was then that she realized that African music could be recorded for an international audience. When she heard Miriam Makeba, she decided that's what she wanted to do. She wanted to sing for the world, not just for Benin or for Africa.
What song would you recommend we listen to first that would really showcase what she's all about?
Well, I think, you know, we'd start off by paying homage to Miriam for influencing this 10-year-old to be an international artist, because I think if she hadn't had Miriam when she did, she wouldn't have done what she's doing today. And she actually paid tribute to Miriam by recording a song called Malaika, which was a huge hit for Miriam on her first album for a major label. I think it's the most covered African song.
Malaika, nakupenda malaika, ningekuwa mariwe, ningekuwa jaja.
It's almost a little haunting, her voice there. It's beautiful. What's it about?
Well, it's about a guy. Malaika is my angel. He's singing to a beautiful woman and saying, if I had money, my Malaika, my angel, I would marry you, but I'm just so poor, I cannot.
When did Angelique's music really take off?
In the early 80s, Angelique took off and went to Paris, where she intended to study law. But she said after attending two classes, she realized law was not for her because, as she said when I spoke to her, the law was written for and by white people. And she thought that that law did not see blacks as equals. And she said she wanted to fight for the rights of Africans, and she did not see how she could fight for the rights of Africans with that kind of law. And so she dropped out. And then she enrolled into a college of music. That's where she took music lessons. From then on, she started recording. She started singing in clubs and also started recording with a band and then by herself. And the very first album, I think, was released in 91.
So what kind of shape did her music take then after her time in Paris studying music? What did it take on a more Western influence, or did she go back to her African roots and really develop those?
It was a mix of both. I think Angelique never makes it a secret that she was really influenced by people like the Rolling Stones, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin. Those are people that she says she listened to as she grew up. But the African influence is still pretty strong in her music.
And she has stayed very rooted to Africa. I mean, she fights for a lot of African causes. She's a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. And she actually has a song, I believe, called Africa, which talks about some of the things she cares about.
Yes, actually, I think what we have here is the live version, which she sang in South Africa in 2004.
How are you tonight?
The inaugural 4664 concert for Nelson Mandela's foundation. And 4664, incidentally, was Nelson's number when he was in prison.
Were you there?
I was there. When you hear that noise, I'm one of those voices.
What was that concert like for you?
Oh, it was amazing, especially when old Nelson shuffled onto the stage. It was just amazing. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to her song called Africa.
Let's do it!
What was she singing about in that song? What are the lyrics talking about?
No, she's just talking about Africa, how Africa is such a wonderful place and the beauty of African people.
You could hear everybody cheering. I thought I could hear your voice in there. you were in that audience, and certainly that kind of music makes you want to get up and dance. Were you dancing?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody was up on their feet.
Talk a little about her latest album, which is titled Jin Jin. It came out last year, and she even won a Grammy for it for Best Contemporary World Music. What do you like about this album?
Well, I see a lot of progress with every album that Angelique makes. It's better than the last one. There's always a lot of collaborations, but I just like the fact that from the very first time that I saw her, she has grown. She's been growing, and she's been also incorporating other influences into her music. She's been to Brazil, and she's also moved to the States. She now lives in Brooklyn, in New York City. She's always worked with, from the very beginning, she's worked with American artists. Branford Marsalis was on her first album.
She's worked with some very well-known musicians. I think on one song she brings in both Carlos Santana and Josh Groban, right?
Yeah, because actually she did say Santana was a major influence for her as well. So I think this was a good move.
Let's play a little bit from her song Pearl, where we'll hear Josh Groban and Carlos Santana playing with her.
There is a woman in Somalia scraping for pearls on the roadside.
There's a force stronger than nature keeps her will alive.
This is how she's dying. She's dying to survive.
Ish, thank you so much for joining us today.
Peggy, thank you very much. It's always fun.
I would like to be that way.
She cries to the heaven above.
That was Ish Mafundakwa, our guide to global music. He spoke to us from Zimbabwe. Just ahead, what would Muhammad Ali say about this? Boxing the traditional way on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. That's the sound of a crowd cheering on their favorite boxer. They're attending a traditional boxing match in northern Nigeria. It looks quite a bit different from the sport you'd see in the U.S., but the winner can take home some big prizes. Sarah Simpson reports.
As the sun sets in the northern city of Sokoto, drummers strike up a beat for the gathering crowds. They're assembling at a fenced-off patch of dusty ground on the town's outskirts for dambe, or traditional Hausa boxing. Dambe is very different than Western boxing. Fighters hit primarily with one fist, tightly bound with rope or cloth. They swing it like a heavy club at their opponent's head. Wrestling moves, kicks, clinches and slaps are also permitted. The first to fall, or even lose their balance, loses the fight. Injuries are common. One of the fighters heading to the Dambe Arena today is Mohammed Dantage. He's also known by his nickname, Champion. He explains in his native Hausa language what brought him to boxing.
I entered boxing because my father was a boxer before me. It attracted me. It helps me to sustain my life, and that's how I get my daily bread. I get everything I have through boxing. That's why I've continued with it.
Dantage is a butcher, as was his father. Traditionally, the Dambe is the preserve of butchers and slaughterhouse workers. Slaughtering animals and selling meat is considered a lowly job in Hausa culture. But a Dambe champion like Dantage can elevate his position in society with the money, gifts and status won in the boxing arena.
I get prizes. Some time ago, someone took me to Mecca. Someone else gave me a motorbike. Someone else gave me clothes, money, so many other things.
But Dantage has paid for his success. He looks older than his 32 years. He's lost half his top teeth on one side, where he took a fierce blow. His face is a mass of scars, bumps, and battle wounds. but it's only improved his success with the ladies, he says.
If you're a good boxer, girls come looking for you.
It's time to head to the ring. Spectators take their seats in plastic chairs around the fighting ring. Singers use sound systems powered by small generators. They play an important role, introducing the fighters, congratulating them, and whipping up the crowd. The first fighters in the arena are young apprentice boys of 10 or 11. The older men fighters look on as they bind their fists. Some make small cuts in their skin and pack the wound with marijuana. This supposedly gives them strength, although some who took too much could hardly swing. Most of the audience are men, though there are some women dressed in bright local fabrics, their head covered in adherence to local Islamic and Hausa traditions. One spectator is Shehu Musa. He says that Dambe is a harvest celebration and show of virility that has spread beyond just the butcher class.
I know from tradition that it happens after every cultivation season. So when people have taken their crops back home, they take a time to come and do what we call the Dambe. It's a festival of showing virility.
Dambe is less common than it used to be, say fans like Musa. But the sport is increasingly attracting poor young men from across Hausa society. Northern Nigeria lies on the southern fringes of the Sahara Desert. It is among the poorest regions of the country. Literacy levels are low, and so are job prospects. Segun Dasabi is at the ringside. He's 25 and a soldier in the Nigerian military, but he's also a Dambe fighter, out to win prizes and money. To make sure of success, he's taken on all the traditions of the sport, including wearing special charms and amulets that he calls medicine to make him strong.
I wear them because no way anybody wants to do boxing.
I wear them because there is no way anyone who wants to box can be successful without them. Eating meat is not enough. You have to have medicine so that you can be sure to knock your opponent out and be sure he doesn't knock you down.
The crowd whoops and shouts as the winner builds up to his victory blow. The winning fighter takes his place before the singers and drummers, who parade him about the arena to bask in his victory. Some spectators throw money at the fighter. Spectator Musa, who these days spends much of his time in London, enjoys the Dambe evenings.
It's something that brings people together culturally. It brings a lot of people. I mean, you can see a lot of people mixing. How many places have you seen people mixing freely like this? People focus on one thing. So this is that's one of the most important entertainment we have, you know? And it's relaxing, even though we don't hit each other. It's them that are doing the job.
This is Sarah Simpson for the World Vision Report in Sokoto, Nigeria.
Disadvantaged Americans sometimes suffer from diseases most of us have never even heard of. These diseases are hard to avoid if you live in crowded conditions without proper sanitation or access to health care. Dr. Peter Hotez wrote about the topic in the journal called Neglected Tropical Diseases. He's a scientist at George Washington University, and he usually focuses on combating disease in developing countries. But when he started looking into the issue at home, he found something that astonished him.
There are neglected infections that affect the poorest people in the United States that for all the world resemble neglected tropical diseases that occur in developing countries.
So they're not the same diseases as the ones we normally refer to as tropical diseases in the developing world?
Well, some of them are. Some of them are the same neglected tropical diseases that occur in the developing world. The others are somewhat unique to the United States, or more even more common in the United States than they are in developing countries. The common denominator is poverty. These are diseases that afflict only the poorest people who are exposed to these infectious agents.
Well, tell us, if you would, what are some of the major ones that we might not have heard much about?
Actually, the most prevalent infection is called toxocariasis. And toxocariasis is also caused by the larval stages of a parasitic worm. And it's a worm that's transmitted from dogs. So this is an infection that's more common in our inner cities. And what happens is dogs, frequently stray dogs, but sometimes pet dogs, are defecating in sandboxes and playgrounds. And then kids are coming into contact with the eggs.
What are the symptoms of this disease? When would you first see this showing up in a child?
Well, oftentimes the disease will produce asthma. And so one of the issues that we're looking into is whether this unexplained rise in asthma that's been seen among inner cities, possibly part of it could be due to infection with this parasite called Toxocara, producing toxocariasis.
How many cases are there of this disease right now in the United States in the inner city, would you say?
I estimate upwards of 2.8 million cases, and that's based on preliminary studies conducted by the Center for Disease Control showing that children have antibodies to the parasite, and the reason they have antibodies is because they've been exposed to the parasite. Now, what percentage of those 2.8 million kids are actually getting asthma and severe symptoms for it, we really don't know. Again, because these are neglected diseases, we haven't really had the opportunity to study them in depth.
It's almost amazing that almost 3 million children could have this parasite that could cause such damaging problems, and the health community is almost silent about it. How do we have this kind of disconnect?
Well, I do want to address that. I just want to bring up one other additional infection, and then I'd like to really focus in on this issue because I think you've really gotten to it. Another example is congenital cytomegalovirus, another very unwieldy name.
I've decided that these names may be part of the problem. It seems like we ought to find names that are a little bit easier to carry around.
Well,
with us.
Maybe this is the first step to start thinking about that. But for instance, congenital cytomegalovirus is an important cause of intellectual retardation and deafness. If you go into homes or institutions for the mentally retarded in the United States, an important cause is this virus that's passed on from mother to baby. The literature indicates that there's about 6,500 African-American babies born with congenital cytomegalovirus every year. This is an infection that could be prevented if we could accelerate the development of a vaccine. There's been a vaccine developed for other purposes. For instance, transplant patients can also get this virus. It's been developed for them, but no one is accelerating the development of the vaccine to prevent transmission from mother to baby of this preventable cause of retardation.
Well, why, if this is so prevalent, are people not really fighting to come up with a vaccine? I mean, there's a lot of interest in healthcare in urban areas, isn't there?
I believe there's not. I think, you know, one of the reasons why cysticercosis and congenital cytomegalovirus are not household words is, one, because the names are unwieldy, but predominantly it's because these are diseases of the poor. These are infections that predominantly do not occur among the wealthy living in suburban United States. So it represents a huge health disparity that occurs in this country. If 6,500 babies of wealthy families were getting intellectual retardation and deafness, we would never tolerate it.
I'm sure you have come up with some recommendations so that there would be an increased public health awareness and control of these diseases. What should be done, and is it really feasible?
There are at least three measures that in this paper that's published, and the journal is called PLOS, Public Library of Science, Neglected Tropical Diseases. There are three measures that I recommend. One of them is that the estimates that I provide in the paper are quite preliminary, meaning that they're based on very limited and spotty data. We need to have a national effort at increasing our data collection so that we can collect more information about these diseases. Recommendation number two is we need to better define the transmission of these diseases. You know, some people like to say that these are immigrant problems. It's not true. There is transmission in the United States, within the borders of the United States. We've just not taken the time to really define how and when transmission of these diseases are occurring. And then finally, we need stepped up measures to accelerate the development of new diagnostic methods using more modern technologies and new vaccines and new drugs for these neglected infections of poverty. So I think it's a three-pronged attack.
Dr. Peter Hotez, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Peter Hotez is the chair of George Washington University's Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Tropical Medicine. At the beginning of the show, we brought you a story about Somaliland, the region that broke away from Somalia 17 years ago. Now, Somaliland has its own flag, its own national anthem, and its own passport. But since Somaliland isn't recognized by the international community, its citizens hold passports that are useless. And neighboring Somalia won't issue passports to citizens of its renegade province. That creates a catch-22 for Somalilanders who want to travel outside the country. Richard Locke explains in the latest installment of our Street Vendor series.
On a busy roadside, 26-year-old Hussein sits behind a metal box piled high with brick-sized bundles of cash. Hussein makes a living as a black market money changer, exchanging Somaliland shillings into US dollars. But look a little more closely and you'll spot his sideline. Wedged into the mound of bills is a single, brand spanking new green passport. Emblazoned in gold print across the cover are the words Republic of Somalia, the country Somaliland broke away from. It's illegal for us to hold a Somalia passport here, Hussein tells me, because our government says we're a separate country. But no one recognizes our passport, so to get travel visas, we have no option but to buy a Somalia passport. Obtaining the passport in the first place is no problem for Hussein. Somalia epitomizes the term dysfunctional state, and its border with Somaliland is as porous as international borders get. This might be the black market, but Hussein makes no effort to conceal what he's selling. The government doesn't bother us, he says. You know, they travel abroad and have to use a Somalia passport just like anyone else. So what can they do? So, for just $42, a Somalia passport can be yours. Just paste in a photo, enter your personal details, black ink is advised, and sign on the dotted line. There does appear to be one hurdle, however. The space reserved for the Minister of Immigration's signature. He sits hundreds of miles away in Mogadishu, a city engulfed by civil war. But not to worry, Hussein has a way of circumventing that. The minister doesn't sign it, he says. We forge his signature and stamp. So while Somalilanders look to the outside world for formal recognition, Hussein is quite happy capitalizing on Somaliland's passport to nowhere. The only problem is that he doesn't exactly do a brisk trade. In a good week, he'll sell only two or three passports. The vast majority of Somalilanders are too poor to travel anywhere. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Hargeisa, Somaliland.
We end today's show with an audio postcard. Reporter Grant Fuller was working on a story in Liberia. He visited a couple of churches there. One was the large and well-equipped Providence Baptist Church in the capital, Monrovia. This is the tiny worldwide mission church on the beach in the small village of Nyangba. The church has about 12 members who all meet in a thatch roof hut with cheap posters of Jesus on the wall. The sound of two very different churches in Liberia in that audio postcard from Grant Fuller. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can find out more about the show on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can download a podcast there, and you can read the blogs from our reporters around the world. You can also post your comments. We're always interested in your feedback about the show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepard are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.